From ABC News, this is Perspective, a closer look at the week's top stories and the stories you may have missed. I'm Daria Albinger. Coming up, mixed messaging on masks and a COVID-19 vaccine from the president and the CDC director.
I think he made a mistake when he said that. It's just incorrect information. And I called him, and he didn't tell me that, and I think he got the message maybe confused.
How climate change is intensifying this year's natural disasters.
It does cool down. We seem to forget that fire season will be around the corner again, and what's to say that the next fire season isn't going to be worse?
And we examine the case of Vanessa Guillen and if it represents a turning point in America.
This story not only resonated with Latinos, it's a much broader issue, the problems they're having at Fort Hood. And I think that has everyone paying attention.
All ahead on Perspective. This week, we saw wildfires continue to torch the western part of the U.S. and another hurricane make landfall in the south. We'll get to that later in the show. But we are going to start this week by talking about the election, which is less than 50 days away. Throughout the fall, ABC News is working with the Washington Post on polling in a series of in-depth battleground states, the first of which was released this week. ABC's Catherine Falders has more on the findings.
According to a pair of new ABC News Washington Post polls, it's a close race in the battleground state of Wisconsin, while former Vice President Joe Biden has a substantial lead in Minnesota. Heading into the final 7 weeks of the presidential campaign, Biden has 52% among likely voters in Wisconsin, with 46% for President Trump. In Minnesota, suburban residents and independents are boosting Biden to a substantial lead, 57-41%. Results are very similar among the broader pool of registered voters, with Biden-Trump at 50-46% in Wisconsin and 57-40% in Minnesota. Views on the economy and the coronavirus define the race, and turnout is a wild card. As is the case nationally, Trump benefits from much greater enthusiasm among his supporters, and they're far more apt to plan to vote on Election Day. That makes Biden's ability to mobilize early in absentee voting central to the outcome.
Florida, another battleground state, is causing concern for the Biden campaign. Campaigning journalist Armando Garcia tells us Biden is struggling to reach Latino voters.
Back in July, a Quinnipiac poll had Biden with a 17-point lead over the president among this demographic in Florida. But last week, an NBC Marist poll showed Biden trailing the president 46-50%. Now, when you look at 2016, Clinton bested Trump among Latinos in Florida 62-35%. This is a major cause for concern among some Latino advocates. Why? Because in less than 2 weeks, eligible voters will be receiving their mail-in ballots in Florida, and they say that the time to court these voters is now or never. Latinos are historically underpolled and underreported in surveys of voting trends and even demographic estimates. However, we know that there are about 3.1 million eligible Latino voters in Florida. That's a lot of people, especially in a state that is historically won by very thin margins. Clinton lost the state to Trump by a little over 1%, meaning that every single vote counts. And we have to remember, Latinos are projected to be the largest group of non-white eligible voters in 2020. And they are not a monolith. They hail from dozens of countries, different backgrounds, political experiences that shape the way they look at candidates.
Now, as we're tracking this show on Friday, the nation is close to reaching another grim coronavirus milestone, 200,000 deaths related to COVID-19. This week, President Trump openly contradicted CDC Director Dr. Robert Redfield at a White House press briefing on Wednesday regarding the effectiveness of masks and when vaccines might be available to the public. Dr. Redfield testified in front of the Senate Appropriations Committee earlier that day. Democratic presidential candidate Joe Biden questioned the president's leadership during the pandemic on the same day.
Folks, the president's first responsibility is to protect the American people. And he won't. It's utterly disqualifying.
ABC's Ann Flaherty got in touch with the CDC this week and received a surprising response. She talked about it on ABC's Daily Podcast Start Here with our Brad Melke.
The single most important question is, when can Americans get a vaccine? What do we know?
Right, Brad. So the timeline is the timeline. It's the same one they've been talking about for weeks now. What we're expecting is that by about November, December, the federal government is going to find a vaccine that they determine is safe and effective, and they're going to give it a green light. They will already have 100 million doses in the hopper. What we're being told is that it's going to be free and it's going to be sent to the most vulnerable populations first. These are, you know, think nursing homes, healthcare workers. And what public health officials have told us from the beginning is that they expect that by the time the entire country is able to get access to this vaccine, it probably won't be until about June, July, sometime mid-2021. That's the timeline everybody has been operating from, and that's the timeline that Dr. Redfield, the head of the CDC, put to the Senate.
Which still feels very far away. And I mean, often we talk about this in terms of, will we get a vaccine before the election or after the election? I think to a lot of Americans, it was news to hear, hey, your life might not be anywhere close to normal until, what, next summer, next fall?
It does. And I mean, this is hard because we're how many days away from the election, under 50 days away from the election. Trump wants to give people hope.
Dr. Redfield confirmed that it looked like November, December, the first doses would be able to be distributed. But then he said that the vaccine for the general public likely would not be available until probably next summer, maybe even early fall. Are you comfortable with that timeline?
No, I think he made a mistake when he said that. It's just incorrect information. And I called him, and he didn't tell me that. And I think he got the message maybe confused.
What he seemed to be doing on Wednesday night during his press conference was trying to give people hope that, you know, the vaccine is coming. It's coming very soon. You're going to see it by the end of the year.
To the general public, very shortly there. I mean, it really to the general public immediately. When we go, we go. We're not looking to say, gee, in 6 months, we're going to start giving it to the general public.
Technically, that is true. But it probably will come to these very narrow populations. It's not going to necessarily be in your local pharmacy. It's going to be in these nursing homes or these healthcare workers.
I might even go so far as to say that this face mask is more guaranteed to protect me against COVID than when I take a COVID vaccine, because the immunogenicity may be 70%.
No, the mask is not as important as the vaccine. The mask perhaps helps. Don't forget, a lot of people didn't like the concept of masks initially.
And then in that same press conference, Trump also contradicts him about masks. After President Trump gives this press conference, I reach out to the CDC and say, you know, essentially, what gives? He says, you made a mistake in your testimony. They get back to me and then they say, well, okay, so here's a little bit of a clarification. What Dr. Redfield meant to say was that the majority of Americans by the middle of next year will have completed their vaccinations. So that's a little bit different than what he said in his testimony. Then less than an hour later, CDC gets back to me and says, actually, we need to rescind that statement. The president has essentially rebuked the CDC director for his testimony. There's been this confusing kind of election year flip-flop. Didn't come from a politician. It came from the CDC director.
ABC's Ann Flaherty speaking with Brad Mielke on the ABC News Daily Podcast Start Here. And on Friday, the CDC appeared to have walked back guidance it issued in late August that testing might not be necessary if you are asymptomatic, even if you've been exposed to COVID-19. As of Friday afternoon, the agency's website now says you need a test if you've been in close contact to someone with coronavirus, even without symptoms. A bill was introduced to Capitol Hill this week honoring Houston native and Fort Hood specialist Vanessa Guillen. The bill, titled I Am Vanessa Guillen, would allow active duty members to file sexual harassment and assault claims to a third party. Vanessa's tragic story has received national attention since she disappeared earlier this year. Vanessa enlisted in the Army after graduating from high school in 2018 and was stationed at Fort Hood, where she was allegedly murdered on April 22nd by a fellow soldier, Specialist Aaron David Robinson. Robinson, along with his girlfriend, allegedly committed a gruesome crime, beating her, dismembering her body, and burying her remains near a Texas river. Robinson then committed suicide. Her family says Vanessa told them she was being sexually harassed on the base, though the Army says they couldn't find evidence of it. Vanessa was just 20 years old. ABC News correspondent John Quinones has followed this story from the very beginning. He recently traveled to speak with the Guillen family, his full report airing on an ABC News 2020 special. John spoke with Vanessa's mother, Gloria, who said her daughter came to dislike Fort Hood.
She looks more sad, si se, más triste.
Sí, porque
She was not happy at Fort Hood. No estaba alegre ella.
No.
John also spoke with her sisters.
I was like, what's going on? She was like, we think Gwyneth is going, it's missing. And I was like, how can she go missing on a military base? That's ridiculous. Go find her and better find her.
They didn't tell their mother the full details of Vanessa's death. Her sisters helped lead protests outside Fort Hood for weeks, demanding justice for Vanessa after it took months to find her body. John then traveled to the Pentagon, where he sat down for an interview with the Secretary of the Army, Ryan McCarthy, who says he doesn't know if there will ever be justice for Guillen.
The Guillen family has said that the Army has left them in the dark as to what happened the day their daughter vanished.
We had a lot of contact with the family, about 40 different instances from April 22nd to July 1st. But when a family endures something as horrible as this, they want information immediately. We're as angry and as disappointed as they are. We've tried to get the answers as quickly as we can.
On the day that Vanessa's remains were found, Specialist Robinson is put under the watch of an unarmed escort. How does the prime suspect in Vanessa's disappearance escape from a military base, somehow get a hold of a gun, and then kill himself?
That's part of what we've asked General Murray to look at in his investigation as to what actions were taken and how they followed procedures. I don't have enough information to truly understand the specifics of what happened at that moment.
Mr. Secretary, it's been more than 4 months and thousands of hours of investigation. How can the Army have no idea what Robinson's motive was?
Not being able to question him, we have not been able to find these facts.
Is there anything you want to say to the Guillen family?
We're incredibly disappointed and heartbroken for the loss of our teammate. We let you down, but we'll do everything in our power to never allow things like this happen again and to make enduring change for our institution.
Will there ever be justice for Vanessa Guillen?
I don't know.
This week, I spoke with John as part of ABC News' programming event Turning Point, where we report across all shows and platforms, confronting the systems and institutions that were built to disenfranchise people of color and have shaped this country throughout its history, and showcase the work being done to enact change. We talked about Vanessa's death and the impact it's had on Hispanic and Latinx communities in the United States. What was it like sitting down and talking to Vanessa's family? You know, we've seen the pain on their faces when they've spoken out on TV. This story is just so tragic, and it is so disturbing on so many levels. So what was it like to sit next to them and talk about it with them?
Heart-wrenching to sit with that family as they were crying out for answers. You know, they suffered through one of life's greatest tragedies, the loss of their daughter. You know, remember, Vanessa was only 20 years old. Now add to that the pain of not knowing for more than 2 months whether she was dead or alive. Then the lone suspect in the murder runs away and somehow gets a gun and then dies by suicide. So there'll be no justice because they'll never be able to confront their daughter's killer. And just the anguish of not getting any real answers from officials there at Fort Hood. The family was devastated, heartbroken. You know, they were angry. You know, I've covered a lot of murder cases for ABC News, and the only story that I can compare this to is the murder of Texas Tejano singer Selena, which I covered 25 years ago. These were both young Mexican-American women whose lives were cut so short by murder and whose deaths sparked tremendous outrage and outpouring from the Latino community, which responded that community with widespread demonstrations and then touching tributes.
For the Latino community, this is huge. We've seen murals dedicated to her, and we've seen how her service was recognized, but her heritage was recognized as well. And of course, you know, we've got the hashtags that we've seen on social media, I am Vanessa Guillen. So how do you think this story is resonating with the Hispanic and the Latinx communities across the country?
It's resonating loudly and powerfully with the Hispanic and Latinx community. Thanks to social media, that story with that hashtag, Daria, that you mentioned, I am Vanessa Guillen, went viral. Protesters took up the Guillen family's cause because it seemed like such an injustice. People and young Latinos in particular were outraged. I think Vanessa, you know, represented the best in us, you know, the most patriotic among us. Let's not forget that 16% of the soldiers in the Army are Hispanic. 18% of the enlisted men and women in the Marines are Latino. And that number has been growing. But, you know, the fact is that this story not only resonated with Latinos, it's a much broader issue, the problems they're having at Fort Hood. There have been at least 28 soldiers who have disappeared or died at or near the base in the last year. In the last 4 years, more soldiers from Fort Hood have died from homicides than in combat. And I think that has everyone sitting up and paying attention.
That's just so mind-boggling how that's happened. And, you know, how it almost seems like not that much concern about that.
There's little doubt that because of all that, the relationship between Hispanics and the U.S. military has been affected, you know, maybe frayed a bit. There are those who will argue that had Vanessa been white, her disappearance would have been solved much sooner and perhaps her killer brought to justice. You know, Vanessa's family, by the way, doesn't think so. They don't think her being Hispanic had anything to do with the handling of the case. But having said that, until the Army takes concrete actions to remedy the problems at Fort Hood, the family's saying that young people should not enlist in the military.
You know, it might be endemic at Fort Hood, but if it's happening there, isn't it happening in other places too?
You have to wonder. It's certainly worse there. I mean, the Army Secretary says it's worse there than at any other military installation. Sexism, bullying, sexual harassment, sexual abuse, prostitution, child pornography rings, all of that there. And until recently, it seemed like those problems were not taken seriously.
And why is that?
I think it's because of the systemic problems that exist, I think, at that military base, inherent problems. That's the only way you can explain it, where, you know, also, you know, military prosecuting, investigating their own cases. So often when you had the victim of sexual harassment, for example, complain about being harassed, the person investigating this might know both the victim and the alleged perpetrator, right? So there seems to be a conflict of interest there. The military, the Army is now saying we're about to change all that. And there's a new major general now in charge at Fort Hood, John Richardson. Several investigations are underway. A woman has been charged not with the murder, but helping dispose of Vanessa's remains. She was the alleged girlfriend of the killer, they say. There should be a trial there soon, so maybe she will have some light to shed on all this.
At ABC News, we're in the midst of our Turning Point series, where we're taking a look at the racial reckoning in America, and if it's going to lead to lasting reconciliation, lasting changes, do you think that Vanessa's tragic death will mark a turning point in America, and if so, in what way?
I think it will. I think it's starting to already, that it is marking a turning point, at least at Fort Hood. Besides the changes that I mentioned, just this week, a bill was introduced in Congress that would make it easier for victims to report sexual assault and sexual harassment in the military. It's being called the I Am Vanessa Guillen Act. And I have to tell you, Daria, there's been a turning point even in our media coverage of Vanessa's case. 2020 devoted 2 full hours to her story and her family's push for justice. It was the highest rated TV broadcast on the air that night. And then Nightline devoted its entire show to the Vanessa Guillen story. And I have to tell you, as a Latino, it was so impressive to hear for the first time in my recollection, people speaking in Spanish on American television. So I think these times, they really do appear to be changing.
ABC News correspondent John Quinones speaking on the death of Vanessa Guillen. Coming up, climate change and natural disasters. We break down how global warming is playing a role in the historic wildfires and hurricane season on Perspective after this.
Hey, I'm Andy Mitchell, a New York Times bestselling author.
And I'm Sabrina Kohlberg, a morning television producer.
We're moms of toddlers and best friends of 20 years.
And we both love to talk about being parents, yes, but also pop culture.
So we're combining our two interests by talking to celebrities, writers, and fellow scholars of TV and movies.
Cinema, really.
About what we all can learn from the fictional moms we love to watch.
From ABC Audio and Good Morning America, Pop Culture Moms is out now wherever you listen to podcasts.
I'm Jane Perlez, longtime foreign correspondent and former Beijing bureau chief for The New York Times. I've been a foreign correspondent in lots of places, Somalia, Indonesia, Pakistan, but nowhere as important to the world as China.
I mean, China is not dropping anti-democratic paratroopers into Montana. But of course, we did see things like the weather balloon slash spy balloon riveting the whole country for a week.
This is Face Off, an eight-part series in which we'll take you behind the scenes to key moments in the tumultuous U.S.-China relationship. We'll speak with a diplomat, a spy, a tech reporter, a U.S. admiral, even Yo-Yo Ma. Plus, my pal and noted China historian Rana Mitter joins the conversation. We'll look at what's driving the two nations apart and explore whether anything can help bring them back together. Face Off launches April 9th.
From ABC News, this is Perspective, a closer look at the week's top stories and the stories you may have missed. I'm Daria Albinger. Coming up, is it possible to get a raise in this economy? We'll dig a little deeper into that question later on. But first, Hurricane Sally made landfall this week in the South, and unprecedented and historic wildfires continued to torch the western U.S. Officials in California and the Pacific Northwest, as well as scientists, pointed to these natural disasters as hard evidence that climate change is a global threat and scientific reality impacting American communities. President Trump this week pointed to forest mismanagement as one reason behind the fires and expressed skepticism about climate change at a press briefing with California's State Secretary for Natural Resources.
If we ignore that science and sort of put our head in the sand and think it's all about vegetation management, we're not going to succeed together protecting Californians.
Okay. It'll start getting cooler.
You just watch. I wish science agreed with you.
Well, I don't think science knows, actually.
Melissa Griffin is a meteorologist with ABC's weather unit. She's been researching the role climate change has played in recent wildfire and hurricane activity. I talked to Melissa about some of her findings. If we can start at the most basic level, what exactly is forest management? And what's climate change and what role are each of these playing in these fires?
So forest management in general is just the overall administration, and that includes legal, economic, social aspects, as well as the scientific and technical aspects of managing the forest, especially out west, because we have a lot of forests out west. So it's pretty much forest regulation. For example, if you have a dead tree that falls in one of the forests out west, forest management is the one that are in charge of removing it, so it's not a danger to anything else. And if it does fall and it is dead, it is going to dry up even rapidly, and that's going to be an issue when it comes to these wildfires. So that's why that is related. A lot of people ask, you know, what is climate change? What does that have to do with weather? Well, climate and weather are two different things. Weather, you look at your weather app, you look at your local meteorologist, they're telling you what the temperature is going to be, if it's going to rain that day. What climate is the average of many, many days, months, years of those temperature and rainfall records that we see. We take them and we average them over a long period of time, and that's how we determine the climate in a certain area. Now, when you add change to that, that is how the climate is changing, whether that be from natural events or human related. So the Earth's surface is warming. We have scientific evidence that this is happening. For hundreds of years that climate has changed, but we're concerned because it is warming at a very fast rate, faster than we've ever seen before. And many of our warmest years on record have happened in just the last 20 years. So now back to the combination of both. Management policies have created tinderboxes, and that's because they're not removing these dead trees and dead brush fast enough in the forests. Now, climate change has only made it more likely that these tinderboxes that forest management is creating will explode into massive fires, and they will spread and grow faster and bigger than what we've ever seen before.
President Trump says things are going to cool down, Is that the case?
Well, of course it's going to cool down when it comes to weather. There's seasons. Winter will cool down. Fire season 2020 comes to an end, and that's it. But then what about fire season 2021? You know, when it does cool down, we seem to forget that fire season will be around the corner again. And what's to say that the next fire season isn't going to be worse? Now, that's the weather aspect. But when it comes to climate, nothing is cooling down. All of the scientific research when it comes to our warming climate just has these graphs going up.
Are all of these wildfires only burning in forests? If they're burning in other places, doesn't that indicate that climate change is, in fact, playing a central role in these fires?
Forest management is one aspect of it. That's just the aspect of these fires burning in the actual forests. And of course, that's an issue that should be taken care of. But what about outside of the forest? We're talking about neighborhoods. We're talking about building areas. It's, you know, more populated regions. And that does have to do with climate change. Anywhere can see these massive fires grow, especially out west. The entire world is warming at an alarming rate, but the Pacific coast, they've seen some of the most dramatic temperature increases. If we're outside of a forest, you're in someone's backyard and there's a bunch of dry sticks out there, well, you're going to look at how dry it is, how hot it is, a little bit of gusty wind, someone throws something and that thing ignites, that can be the next massive fire going through a neighborhood. So it's not just forest mismanagement. This can happen anywhere, and the western states are the most vulnerable because of climate change impacting them with their severe heat waves and severe drought.
We saw Sally make landfall this week, but that wasn't the only hurricane. Several others just didn't reach the U.S.
Hurricanes are probably one of the biggest meteorological events that we cover and that we track, the biggest natural disaster that can, you know, harm life and property. So what does climate change do to that role in hurricanes? And well, we talked about the warming planet. The land masses are warming, the oceans are warming. So first off, with the rapid intensification, we're seeing a tendency for these storms to intensify more rapidly. And you have these warm ocean waters. And the worst part about this is those warmer ocean waters, warmer than normal, close to a coastline. That's when you have that rapid intensification just a day out before making landfall. And that's when you have people that aren't prepared for, say, a category 4 or 5 hurricane if they thought it was going to be a 2 or 3. Two, the moisture content. Now, this is going to be a perfect example for Hurricane Harvey, where we saw record-breaking rainfall. When you have warmer water, you have higher moisture content. When you have stalled weather patterns, you're going to see these hurricanes packing a ton of moisture, just ready to dump feet of rain wherever it's going to make landfall. And then the problem is with these stuck patterns, the storm doesn't move. Hurricane Sally, just this week, it didn't move. It was going 2 miles per hour, dumping feet of rain over the same areas. And that's where you get the life-threatening and catastrophic flash flooding on top of the storm surge.
How much can we affect climate change? And worst case scenario, if we don't do anything, what happens?
Well, I think the worst case scenario is if we don't do anything, is this just continues to exacerbate itself each and every year. And we keep seeing the climate and the global temperatures and the global ocean waters continue to rise. And that is what we're really trying to avoid here, because the more that happens, the more we're going to see, you know, glaciers melting. We're going to see things that we have never seen in our lifetime before. It's almost a question mark. Who knows what's going to happen if this continues? You know, the greenhouse gases and the carbon emissions, we're seeing those levels going up. If we can try to limit that as much as possible. I mean, if we don't do anything, it's a big question mark. We don't even know what could happen. This is already what's happening as we see the global temperatures warming and breaking records.
ABC News meteorologist Melissa Griffin on climate change and natural disasters in the U.S. When restaurants, stadiums, and arenas closed to coronavirus lockdowns, there was a lot of beer lying around. But it wasn't being thrown out. In fact, it went right back where it came from.
41 million servings of expired beer that's returned to the breweries is going to be put through a process known as BRRRS. It's an anaerobic digestion system that creates methane. Simplest terms, old beer helps make fuel that fuels the plant to make the new beer.
ABC chief meteorologist Jinju Z recently visited the Anheuser-Busch factory and spoke with the company's chief supply officer, Dave Taylor, about using nearly 250,000 stale kegs of old beer to make new beer.
Still kegs come back in and go straight to their brew house. The old beer is treated like any other waste in the brewing process.
We dump it in a brew hall, and then we're able to send it over to brewers and capture that waste back. Then we use that to brew fresh beer. We get fresh beer out to those venues.
Once it's decanted, the beer goes through their brewer's system.
All the process waste from the brewery, they'll go into tanks, and that's where our biomass goes to work. And the biomass will take all the organics, chew them up, produce some methane gas. We recover that, take it over here to our powerhouse where we use it to fuel the brewery.
The company told Ginger it's expanded its use of solar panels and may be using 100% renewable energy by 2021. Renewable energy and solar panels are not just reserved for America's biggest brewers, though, as ABC producers Leighton Schneider and Mike Dubusky discovered when they stopped by a local brewery in Connecticut. They explored how that brewer's gone completely solar and may one day be off the grid.
Rob Kay was only looking for a central location to build fences when he purchased a building right off Route 7 in Ridgefield, Connecticut. Little did he know that building would become home to a groundbreaking brewery powered by the sun.
The idea for a brewery began in 2008 with his son Dave. When he left college, he moved to the UK and learned how to make and serve cask ale in a pub.
Flash forward a couple of years, after spending nights drinking Marzen beer brewed by monks in Austria, and after brewing a couple of batches of experimental home brews, the idea became a reality.
When Dave and his father decided to start the brewery, Rob knew they had a perfect building already. They also realized there was a perfect roof setup for solar panels.
We have an immense amount of electricity coming into this building. And a lot of buildings do not have that. We wanted to be as green as possible. It had always been in our plan to go solar.
Surprisingly, the costs to set up the solar array weren't crazy.
Because the programs, the government programs that are involved make this very, very worthwhile to do. Huh. There are tax credits, there are depreciation, accelerated depreciation. So when you start to add up all the costs of tax credits and monies paid, over 15 years, just on those alone, it pays for this.
Nod Hill is the state's first and only 100% solar-powered brewery.
They power their equipment with a 287-kilowatt, 700-panel array. It offsets all the brewery's electrical usage, along with the usage of two other businesses in the building.
We actually brew on an electric system, which is somewhat unusual. They're usually, you find them in smaller breweries. We're a 10-barrel brewery, which is not enormous, but it's on the larger side for an electric setup.
But that doesn't mean they're completely off the grid, meaning they do occasionally take in electricity.
The only way you can be 100% off the grid is if you have backup batteries. And the costs of those right now are really prohibitive to do.
So how does the system work?
It's actually pretty simple. When the sun is out and shining, the panels are pulling in energy and feeding it into all of the brewery's systems.
It's automated. Just when the sun hits it, boom, it's collecting. If that sun comes up at 6 a.m. or 8 a.m., you know, we're still going to be using what's generated.
To get a better idea of the array, we head up to the roof.
Hey, Lane, can I give you this when you get up there?
Yeah.
The roof is massive. The building is 32,000 square feet, which means there's plenty of roof space for the solar panels.
This goes on for a while. I mean, we keep talking about how big this building is, but this is... pretty wide.
Rob tells us their array is limited to 287 kilowatts based on what is allowed by Eversource, Connecticut's energy provider.
A lot of this space is not filled. There is a limitation that the electrical company will put on you. They don't want to pay you for the electric, so they look at what your usage is, and then they'll say, okay, these are the amount of panels that you're allowed to put on.
While Nod Hill is the only fully solar-powered brewery in the state, there are several others that use solar power, including Two Roads Brewing in Stratford, Kent Falls Brewery in Kent, and Brewport in Bridgeport. In the future, Rob believes Nod Hill may be able to go completely off the grid with batteries.
Even though we're a little guy, we do use a lot of electricity we have in the past. Now think of that on a larger scale. You know, and their economies of scale are going to be much more than mine because their usage will be much higher.
And as for the future of Nod Hill Brewery, Rob believes they may be able to go completely off the grid with the help of batteries.
If they can bring the batteries down to a reasonable price, then we'll be off the grid. And I think the technology is starting to come through. I think, you know, maybe, you know, 5-10 years from now, yeah, that's where we'll all be.
Reporting for Perspective, I'm Leighton Schneider.
And I'm Mike Dubusky, ABC News.
the pandemic, we've seen unprecedented jobless claims. And once again this week, those numbers held steady. 860,000 Americans filed for unemployment last week. The claims have hovered around 1 million since August, and while the numbers are historically high, they peaked at 6.9 million in the last week of March. And this week's total was the lowest since the pandemic began. You probably know someone, maybe yourself, who's out of work. In all likelihood, it's because of the pandemic. And now you may be looking for a job, or maybe you have a job and you want a raise. Well, the latest salary guides from Robert Half say it may not be too easy to negotiate for more money these days.
The guides are showing us that it's going to be pretty flat in terms of what the future holds for salary increases for employees. Employers are telling us that they're offering benefits other than compensation for the most part due to the pandemic, due to decreases in business. They're doing what they can under the circumstances.
Paul McDonald is Robert Half's senior executive director, and he says, well, your paycheck may not be what you'd hoped for in a new job, or if you're turned down for that raise, your boss or that prospective employer may be willing to offer you other perks. And he says that's due in part to the coronavirus.
Things like work from home will be here to stay. Remote work used to be an optional benefit. Now it's a full-time.
McDonald says that opens up a whole lot of jobs that were once off limits.
I'm getting input from clients. I'm getting input from job seekers that used to live in Boston or New York. They moved because of the pandemic, and now they're getting jobs back in some of those cities because the remote work is being embraced.
And he says, yes, some companies are doing it better than others.
We're finding that the companies that invested heavily in technology prior to the pandemic have actually been very successful in allowing their employees to work remotely. That doesn't make up for some loss of business and doesn't make up for some furloughed employees, but it has made the transition easier. It's a retention conversation because proactive communication will lead to future retention and increased engagement.
But first, you got to get the job. And that could mean swallowing a little pride.
They need to get realistic. They probably will not find the same level position. They need to adjust their expectations, their desires for compensation. Titles should not be considered at all.
CEO and entrepreneur Donna Cornell, author of the book Job Searching in Pandemic Time, says the first step is to dust off that resume and throw it away.
The resume used to be a work history. It cannot be a work history anymore. It needs to be a document that tells the prospective employer why you, why should they bring you in for an interview? And that has to begin with how you create the resume.
And then rethink what kind of job you'll take.
I sincerely recommend that people consider that we are in a gig economy. If you get an opportunity that is short term, whether it's temporary or a contract assignment or even freelance, take it.
So get your stuff in order, and as McDonald says, don't delay.
I think every time's a good time to look for a job.
And remember, that new job may be located in the comfort of your own home. From ABC News, this has been Perspective. Thanks for listening. If you want to listen to any of our past shows, you can subscribe to the Perspective podcast. Give us a review if you've got the time. Tell us what you like and what you'd like to hear in the future. You can find it on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Stitcher, or wherever you listen to your podcasts. You can also find Perspective and other ABC News shows at abcnewspodcast.com. Perspective is produced by Eric Mollo. For ABC News, I'm Daria Albinger.